From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Joseph Galloway reports that some military officials are calling Donald Rumsfeld's war strategy in Iraq a mismatch between expectations and reality. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Galloway about some of the problems with that strategy. Galloway is military affairs correspondent for Knight Ridder Newspapers. He was a war correspondent in Vietnam as well as the first Gulf War. He's the author of the book We Were Soldiers Once and Young about Vietnam. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews the new memoir, The Only Girl in the Car. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. U.S. paratroopers have landed in the Kurdish-controlled portion of northern Iraq. NPR's Tom Gelton reports from the Pentagon.
The United States, it seems, has finally opened a northern front against the Iraqi regime. A defense official here says about 1,000 U.S. paratroopers landed on an airfield in northern Iraq. That would be the part of Iraq that is controlled by Kurdish forces, not by Saddam Hussein. More paratroopers will be coming. This airfield is now under U.S. control. It is being set up as what's called a forward operating base. U.S. aircraft, that would be cargo aircraft, will be landing there shortly, bringing in supplies. So there will be a full-fledged operating base with about 3,000 U.S. soldiers, airborne troops, in northern Iraq.
NPR's Tom Gelton at the Pentagon. The U.S. and Britain kept up their air assaults on Baghdad today. One blast, apparently caused by errant missiles or bombs, struck a market in a Baghdad neighborhood, killing as many as 30 civilians. NPR's Ann Garrels talked to Iraqis at the scene.
They said that they had heard bombing in the distance, but that they just continued to work because they'd become so used to it, and they had become so used to the fact that the targeting has been precise. That it's hit, for the most part, only military or security installations. At one point, some young men ran around holding the hand of one of the victims that had been severed, shaking it at reporters, saying, you know, this is your liberation. This is American democracy.
NPR's Ann Garrels in Baghdad. The Pentagon said it did not target the area where the blasts occurred and that it's still investigating. President Bush went to Tampa, Florida today to visit with troops at MacDill Air Force Base. Bobby O'Brien reports from member station WUSF in Tampa.
Air Force One rolled up just outside a huge open-air hangar at MacDill Air Force Base and within view of the more than 4,000 soldiers, Marines, and sailors waiting to greet their commander-in-chief. The president told the crowd of invited guests that the U.S. had no ambition in Iraq except to liberate its people.
We ask no reward except a durable peace. And we will accept no outcome short of complete and final success.
His speech lasted nearly 30 minutes. The president then lunched with selected soldiers before returning to Washington, D.C. For NPR News, I'm Bobby O'Brien in Tampa.
In stocks today, the Dow lost 50 points to close at 8,229. The Nasdaq lost 3 points to close at 1,387. This is NPR News. The Senate has approved a $2.2 trillion budget resolution that trims President Bush's tax cut proposal by more than half. The measure passed on a vote of 56 to 44. The resolution includes $350 billion in tax cuts over a 10-year period. Former Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan died today. The New York Democrat was 76. He'd been hospitalized 2 weeks ago in Washington with a burst appendix and died from complications of an infection. NPR's David Wellner has more.
Daniel Patrick Moynihan served 24 years in the U.S. Senate, and though a Democrat, he was comfortable working on both sides of the aisle. Hillary Clinton now occupies the seat Moynihan retired from 2 years ago, and she announced his death on the floor of the Senate this afternoon.
We have lost a great American, an extraordinary senator, an intellectual, and a man of passion and understanding about what really makes this country great.
Moynihan served in the cabinets of four consecutive presidents. The former shoeshine boy was also U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. He left his mark on a wide range of social policy, from welfare and social security reform to urban affairs and foreign policy, a legacy more of ideas than actual legislation. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.
A federal jury in Chattanooga, Tennessee, has found Tyson Foods and three of its managers not guilty of violating U.S. immigration laws. The big poultry processor was accused of conspiring to hire illegal immigrants from Mexico and Central America for low-paying jobs at its plants. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, on the web at macfound.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Joseph Galloway, is military affairs correspondent for Knight Ridder Newspapers. He reports that the risks of the military campaign in Iraq are becoming increasingly apparent, and some current and retired military officials are warning that there may be a mismatch between Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld's strategy and the force he has sent to carry it out. Galloway also helped train the Knight Ridder reporters who are embedded with the military and is editing some of their work. Galloway has covered several wars, including Vietnam and the Gulf War of 91. He's the co-author of the book We Were Soldiers Once and Young, about the first major land battle the Americans fought in Vietnam. It was also the bloodiest. Galloway was the only civilian to receive a Medal of Valor from the Army for Vietnam. I spoke with him earlier today and asked him to describe some of the Pentagon's optimistic predictions that have not come true.
Well, there was great expectation that I think was encouraged by the administration, by the political leadership in the Pentagon, that as soon as the American forces crossed the Iraq border, that there would be uprisings against Saddam Hussein throughout the country, that Republican Guard divisions would throw down their rifles and stick up their hands, that this was going to be quick, cheap, bloodless, maybe we would even beat the 100-hour war of the 1991 Persian Gulf War. And these things have not come to pass. Some things have changed in Iraq in the last 11 years, 12 years since the last time.
Things that you think might have led to overly optimistic predictions?
Well, things that have changed with the Iraqi people. During that time, we have maintained an embargo on that country that has led to a great deal of privation amongst the peoples, not starvation necessarily, but certainly harder times. And far from making them angry at Saddam Hussein, I think it's made them angry at us. And so the attitude is different. And the outcome has been different as well. You know, the things that were counted on just haven't come to pass.
So you think the embargo and the resentment it created against America is one of the reasons why we're not being universally greeted as liberators?
Precisely, and not just in Iraq. This is something that is throughout the Arab world. We're hearing talks now of Iraqis who escaped the country turning around and coming back and saying, as they cross the border out of Jordan, "I'm going back to fight the Americans." And reports, too, of volunteers in other Arab countries who say, "We're going there to fight the Americans as well."
Say a lot of that happens. Say a lot of volunteers from other countries come to Iraq to fight the Americans. What implications might that have?
Well, you could have implications for a guerrilla war that drags on. No matter whether we eventually succeed in cracking the hard nut that is Baghdad itself, and that's the main target of our attack right now, it gives rise to some nightmare scenarios for post-war Iraq and keeping the peace and keeping the many ethnic groups and tribal groups and religious groups from going at each other's throats. I'm more afraid of the post-war than I am of the war, and the war itself is scary.
Now, you report that there are some current and retired military officials who are warning that there may be a mismatch between Rumsfeld's strategy and the force he sent out to carry it out. What's the mismatch?
The mismatch is that in Mr. Rumsfeld's version of the plan, there were these expectations of quick success, of the southern Iraq Shiites rising up against the Ba'athist regime and greeting us by throwing rose petals at our tanks, and this has not happened. Mr. Rumsfeld has also embraced a rather revolutionary new way of warfare that has not been tested. He thought in the beginning that we could do this with 60,000, as few as 60,000 troops. He thought that you would have such precision strikes from the air that you would have... You send in teams of special forces operators like you did in Afghanistan, and it would give you a quick success. And that overlooks a whole lot of facts about Iraq, about the fact that they have a pretty large army that is equipped with armor, that they have a great number of these Saddam Fedayeen who really are thugs who've been armed and many of them fighting in civilian clothes. So the plan was shaped in such a way that Mr. Rumsfeld did not listen to his military advisors who kept saying, you know, we need a larger force. We need another armor division. We're not certain that we're going to get the approval you think we're going to get from Turkey to open a northern front with an armor division up there. What that means on the ground is that we are very, very light. We have an army division that has gone up the left side of the Euphrates River. We have a marine column advancing on the right side. But we bypassed these large pockets of Iraqis who are not surrendering. In fact, they're resisting. Now, whether, you know, there's some question, Saddam's strategy was to put these Fedayeen and some tough Republican Guard veterans in places like Umm Qasr, Nasiriyah, and stiffen the resistance, make it so that even those who wanted to surrender couldn't, because if they looked like it, they get shot, the old Soviet method. What this means, in fact, is that the Marine supply lines go through the edge of Nasiriyah, and each column has to fight its way through. This is not good when your supply lines are not secure. Normally, you would send in an armored cavalry squadron to secure those routes, to screen your flanks and defend against this kind of attack so that your fuel and your ammunition and your food can go forward to the frontline trace. And we're having problems with this right now, and we've had problems with it ever since we did this. So things are not going exactly according to Mr. Rumsfeld's plan.
Now, you're saying that your sources tell you that Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld didn't listen to the military when the military told Rumsfeld what it needed. Who did the Secretary of Defense listen to in deciding what kind of strategy we needed?
Well, he was listening to Air Force officers who were telling him that we can do this from the air, that the air is now, the munitions are now so precise, and they are, but that we will be the decisive factor in this war, that we will run a campaign of shock and awe that will paralyze or decapitate the Iraqi leadership. And this has not come to pass. We shocked them and we awed them and they kept working. We made an attempt to take out Saddam Hussein himself in the first moments of the war, and that failed. So he listened to his air people, who always oversell, ever since Claire Chennault in World War II, that wars can be won from the air. And what we know from history is that they cannot. You have to put your young men on the ground with rifles in hand if you want to seize and hold territory. You cannot do it from the air.
What about the first Gulf War? That was a pretty successful air campaign.
Well, it was a pretty successful air campaign, but it was also 6 weeks long. We had no preparation this time. It all started on the same day. Bang! All of the air and the attack across into Iraq. So you had not the 6 weeks of preparation. And I would also point out that in the last Gulf War, the Air Force focused on strategic targets around Baghdad, in Baghdad, to almost the exclusion of the targets that the ground generals wanted hit. They had to beg for it. And I must tell you, I rode with the 24th Mechanized Infantry all the way to the Euphrates River the last time. And we captured two airfields, and the Air Force had said, you have no worries there, we've hit those places. Well, we rolled onto those airfields, and sure enough, all of the hard hangars had a 3-foot hole in the top of them, and the insides were scrambled, but there were no aircraft in there. The aircraft were a couple of hundred meters out in the sand, camouflaged very well, and our tanks killed a lot of MiGs. And so I'm telling you that the Air Force did not deliver even as well as it was portrayed the last time.
You know how at the very start of this war, the military bomb, the target of opportunity, that was, they believed, a bunker that was sheltering, among other people, Saddam Hussein, members of his family, leadership of the regime. How much did that rearrange plans, to your knowledge, of how the war was supposed to start?
Well, it kicked things off, that and the fact that they started blowing up the oil wells in the southern Rumaila oil field advanced things by probably 12 or 24 hours. The ground attack had to kick off early to stop what was happening in the oil fields. And you had hit that bunker, but intelligence officials now tell us that we didn't hit the house next to that bunker, and that, in fact, Saddam and his family and the top leaders were sleeping in the house, not in the bunker. So we missed them.
One of the amazing things about that, if Saddam was actually in a house that was it just next door to the bunker that we bombed?
Just next door to the bunker, apparently.
Well, we came so close, but it also says that, how precise are those weapons if they're that precise that they'd take out the bunker and leave standing the house next door, or not totally demolish the house next door?
Right. They are precise. We are not dropping dumb bombs. Everything we are dropping now is precision-guided munitions. And the intelligence said they would be in the bunker, and we took out the bunker.
My guest is Joseph Galloway, military affairs correspondent for Knight Ridder Newspapers. He reported on the war in Vietnam and the Gulf War. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Joseph Galloway. He's military correspondent for Knight Ridder Newspapers. He's been reporting on the war as well as helping to edit the embedded reporters. He covered the Vietnam War and the first Gulf War and is the co-author of the book We Were Soldiers Once and Young. One of the things I've read, and tell me if this checks out with what you're hearing, is that Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, in planning this war, listened to some of the exiles who he was working with, and that their analysis of what would happen in Iraq if we went to war is proving to be very different from the reality of what we're facing.
Well, that's quite correct. He did. He listened to two sources that were suspect. One were the Iraqi exiles. Exiles often don't have much of a clear picture of what's happening in their home country, and their expectations and hopes are just that. They hope for the best. They hope that they can get us to go take their country back for them. We also saw that the people in the Pentagon were listening to Israeli intelligence, who were saying much the same thing. If you invade, the Republican Guard will surrender in droves, and this is going to be an easy campaign. And at the same time, they're listening to this. They are not listening to the CIA and the Defense Intelligence Agency, who are providing much more sober analysis and much less of a rosy scenario. So it may be a case of listening to what you wanted to hear as opposed to what the truth was.
Give us a picture of what you think is happening behind the scenes now in the Pentagon. Is there a lot of finger-pointing now?
Well, if you watched the briefings yesterday and President Bush's appearance at the Pentagon, you saw Secretary Rumsfeld and General Myers, the chairman, talking about everything's fine. You know, we're not short of people. They're flowing off the airplanes. Hour by hour, our force is growing, and everything in the plan is fine, and it's all going well. And that's exactly what I would expect them to say.
But you're talking to people behind the scenes. What picture are they giving you about what's really happening behind the scenes?
Well, what they are saying is that this is a much tougher job and that we are trying to do it on the cheap in terms of strength, in terms of the number of units that ought to be on the ground, in terms of the fact that we have no reserve. The 4th Mechanized Infantry, which was supposed to land in Turkey, is still sitting. The personnel are all still in Fort Hood, Texas. Their equipment has been on ships for the last 5 weeks, floating off the Turkish coast, and only recently did they head them toward the Arabian Sea. They had to pass the Suez Canal, and the equipment is probably 10 days away from landing in Kuwait. Now, they will move the personnel, but the personnel won't be able to do anything until their equipment gets there, it's offloaded, and so forth. That division should have been on the ground and fighting from the first day. And it is the closest reserves that we have.
You've written, not since Vietnam and Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara have we had a Secretary of Defense and his closest civilian advisors demonstrate so thorough a contempt for the Council of America's military leaders.
That's correct. This has been a drumbeat out of the Pentagon from the day they arrived. They have embraced a theory that the Army is outmoded, that heavy divisions are not needed, that the air power now is so precise and we have all of these new weapons and new tactics that this is going to revolutionize the way war is fought, and that you don't need an armored division to fight with anymore. That's old-fashioned, they say. That's Cold War technology. Well, it is, but sometimes, like right now, it's needed. And they have done their best to get rid of what they need right now.
How difficult has it been to get military insiders to talk with you about their concerns and their reservations about how this war is being fought and what kind of armor they have, what kind of weapons they have, and how many troops they have to fight it.
Well, not very difficult at all, because there are people who are genuinely upset over the fact that we have committed our forces in a very, very high-risk plan. And many of the assumptions of that plan are not coming true, have not come true, which leaves us at a much higher risk. We have only now begun to approach Baghdad, and the plans for taking Baghdad itself are themselves revolutionary. And they are based on a plan that assumes everything will go well, that we will be able to strike so swiftly and decapitate the regime and the very best, highest level targets by sending our forces into the heart of Baghdad and isolating those particular areas where those headquarters are located, and then going through there with infantry companies, taking them out. Well, this is good, but it assumes a lot of things. It assumes that the Air Force can keep the Republican Guard divisions, who are in a ring outside Baghdad, from pulling back into the city and laying traps. It assumes that the population is not going to take a rifle, an AK-47, and a B-2 rocket and go out there and get involved. It assumes that the Saddam Fedayeen and the Ba'athist thugs are not going to be able to take part in this thing. And it's risky beyond all measurement.
I'm going to ask you to speculate here, but why do you think some military insiders would be willing to share their doubts with you at a time when the military is usually doing its best to seem as confident as possible?
Well, because those doubts and concerns are very real, and they have some fear that if this thing goes wrong, if the casualties are much, much higher than anticipated, that Rumsfeld will turn around and blame them and say, this is your fault. You didn't ask for enough. Well, they know that's a lie. And that is enough reason to say their concerns, to speak those concerns now.
Joseph Galloway is military affairs correspondent for the Knight Ridder newspapers. He's also the co-author of We Were Soldiers Once and Young, about a battle in Vietnam which he covered. We'll talk more in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Joseph Galloway talks about how his reporting on the war in Iraq has been affected by the lessons he learned reporting from the battlefields of Vietnam and the Gulf War of 91. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews the new memoir, The Only Girl in the Car. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Joseph Galloway, military affairs correspondent for Knight Ridder Newspapers. He spent 22 years as a foreign and war correspondent for UPI and nearly 20 years as a senior editor and senior writer for U.S. News & World Report. He reported from the battlefields of Vietnam and the First Gulf War. He's the co-author of the book We Were Soldiers Once and Young about the first major land battle the Americans fought in Vietnam. The book was adapted into a film starring Mel Gibson. Galloway reports that military sources tell him that Donald Rumsfeld's war strategy is based on predictions that don't fit the reality the American military is facing. I'm wondering, you're delivering some not very good news to us about how the military is unprepared for what they're facing, and how there's disagreement behind the scenes in the Pentagon. And I wonder how you feel about reporting information that can get some Americans to lose confidence and feel more insecure, and if how you feel about it is informed at all from your experiences reporting on Vietnam.
Well, first off, Terry, I want to say that I never said our military is unprepared. They're magnificently prepared. I think we have the finest military in the world, and I go out among soldiers all the time. I see them training. They work hard 6 days a week, 12, 14 hours a day, and nobody knows it in this country. They are magnificently prepared. There's just not enough of them in the plan. They didn't send enough to do the job with safety. You know, we are now marginal in some areas where the doctrine says we would be stacked up. We would have more than we need because, there's a Soviet proverb, an old Russian proverb, in fact, that says you'd rather have five divisions too many than one division too few. And I don't have a problem talking about the fears and the deficiencies in our planning process. I hope that this will lead to some swift corrective action, that we will move now those things that should have been moved 2 months ago. It is an on-the-edge situation.
Is your reporting now informed at all by your experiences in Vietnam as a reporter?
Well, your reporting is always informed by what you have seen before. And Vietnam, you know, God help us. I hope that we are not going anywhere near that scenario. But we are starting with the Secretary of Defense, who reminds me a great deal of Robert Strange McNamara, the aptly named.
Now, you are working with the embedded reporters who are writing for Knight Ridder papers, and you helped place them, and you helped prepare them for facing battle. How do the rules that the Pentagon has laid down for the embedded reporters in this war, how do those rules compare to the rules that you faced when you reported in Vietnam?
Well, until this moment, Vietnam was the most openly covered war in the history of our country. You showed up, you signed an agreement, very simple operational security rules, that you would not reveal troop movements while they were underway, that you would not reveal actual casualties in a battle while the battle was still underway. Simple things like that. You got your press club and your press card, and you were free to go anywhere you wished in the country, cover any unit, stay as long or as briefly as you wished. You were free. I said that was the most openly covered war to this point. This one is breaking new ground. The fact that the military leadership and the civilian leadership opened it up and embedded 740 media with all of the units involved, air, land, sea, that there are reporters riding with the cavalry units at the head of the charge, and reporting as they go. You have seen the images on television. You've seen the pictures in your papers. You've read their dispatches. It is breathtaking. It is breathtaking. And we are seeing more of a war than we have ever seen before.
I want to ask you about your experiences in Vietnam for a moment. You were the only civilian decorated during that war. What did you do to be decorated?
Well, I belatedly was given a Bronze Star with V, the only one the Army gave a civilian during the entire war for rescuing a wounded soldier during the Battle of Landing Zone X-Ray, an event that in fact is portrayed in the movie We Were Soldiers, which was released last year. A very shocking friendly fire incident where a napalm canister exploded almost in the middle of the command post, and a young engineer specialist that I had talked to earlier was engulfed in the flames, and a medic and I both jumped up and ran toward him, and the medic was shot through the head and killed, and I got to him and helped bring him back to the medics, but he was so badly burned that he died the following day. It's interesting. For years, I looked for his widow and baby daughter, who was born just a few days before he was killed. Couldn't find them, but the movie brought them out and brought them to our reunion last Veterans Day, and I had the opportunity to sit down and talk to them for a long time.
That must have been good to finally meet her.
It was. I think it was a healing thing for both of us, for all of us.
My guest is Joseph Galloway, military affairs correspondent for Knight Ridder Newspapers. He reported on the war in Vietnam and the Gulf War. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Joseph Galloway, military affairs correspondent for Knight Ridder Newspapers. He's a former war correspondent for UPI and former senior editor and writer for U.S. News and World Report. He reported from Vietnam and the First Gulf War. Some of the embedded reporters that you're working with, for them this is their first war. Did they ask for your advice about whether they should, come to the rescue? Or whether they should just kind of hang back and be the observer reporter?
You know, I wrote a three-page memo to all of them with basically common sense advice on what to carry and how to conduct yourself and what you do if there's a sudden attack. I concluded that by telling them, you know, it's okay to be a human first, and a reporter second. It's okay to lend a hand in an emergency to help carry the wounded, to bring water to the soldiers. Whatever seems the right thing to do, do it, because your fate is inextricably bound up with theirs.
You actually carried a gun during part of the Vietnam War. What led you to arm yourself?
Well, I what led me to arm myself was experience. I had been inside the Special Forces camp at Play Me in October 1965 when it was under siege from a regiment of North Vietnamese. It was a very close-run thing, and we weren't sure that any of us were going to survive. The camp commander was a famous fellow, then Major Charlie Beckwith, who later would go on to found the Delta Force and lead the abortive raid into the desert in Iran, trying to rescue our hostages. And when I arrived there, Beckwith looked at me and he said, "You know, I have no vacancy for a reporter, son, but I need a corner machine gunner, and you're it." And he put me on a machine gun and told me what to do and who to shoot. And I was given basically no choice. I had no ride out of there, and so I did as I was ordered. And when I was leaving there, Major Beckwith said, "You don't have a weapon." And I said, "Well, in spite of what you've made me do for the last 3 days, technically speaking, I'm a non-combatant." And he looked at me and he shook his head and he said, "Technically speaking, son, there's no such thing in these mountains. You need a rifle. Sergeant Major, get this man a rifle." And I had that rifle on my shoulder 3 weeks later when I went into landing zone X-ray. And there, and only there, during the rest of my time in Vietnam did I use that weapon.
What did you use it for?
And only in the direst of circumstances.
What was the circumstance?
Well, we were seemingly about to be overrun by the enemy. And I thought that I had no choice for my own safety and survival and the survival of those around me.
So you shot?
I did.
How would you feel?
No apologies.
How would you feel if one of the embedded reporters that you're working with now was carrying a gun?
It was recommended by the Pentagon that they not do so. However, the situation in some instances recently has gotten so dicey that one of our female reporters was offered a pistol and told that she needed to do a turn guarding the perimeter.
And what happened?
Well, she turned the pistol down. She said she didn't know how to operate it and she wouldn't be much good on guard.
How do you think the volunteer army, the professionalized army, compares to the army of the draft era?
Well, the army today, the kids today who serve in the ranks and the NCOs are much more sophisticated than they were in 1965. They have a whole different set of skills. They have a whole different way of looking at the world. They're another generation or two removed, but at heart, a soldier is a soldier. They're fine. They're much better trained. Their arms are much better, but in their hearts, they are the same as those fine soldiers, draftees who marched into the Iodrang Valley. Some of them with less than a week left on their tour of duty, and died there. In one of his famous misstatements, Secretary Rumsfeld was asked about a proposal that we return to the draft for the military, and he said, "Oh, they're useless. Basically, they're just a waste of money and time." And by so doing, he offended every Vietnam veteran draftee and every draftee who ever served this country well. He had to apologize, and quite rightly.
Hmm. Our stated goal is to, find the weapons of mass destruction and quote, liberate the people of Iraq. If we have to fight urban warfare in Baghdad, that risks endangering civilians, because it's urban warfare. That's one of the awful problems of urban warfare. Could you speculate a little bit what it might mean if we're fighting urban warfare and a lot of civilians are killed because it's hard for them to escape the battle?
if we are forced into urban warfare in Baghdad, the casualties will rise exponentially amongst civilians, amongst our soldiers, and amongst their soldiers. Fighting for a city is a bloodbath situation. You know, look in history. Look at Stalingrad. Thousands upon thousands upon thousands were ground up in a meat grinder that lasted 6 months and virtually just leveled the city. The last time we fought a war for a city was Hue in the Tet Offensive in 1968, and the Marines eventually, in 4 weeks' time, took the city back from 10,000 of the enemy. But when they were done, the city was about 18 inches tall. It was a pile of rubble. You know, our military planners don't want that. They want to do, you know, more or less surgical strike into the heart of the city and lop off the heads of their political and military machines and get out and then let it all collapse. But that's so optimistic. That's so almost Pollyannish that it's highly worrisome. Once you go in, things may not happen as you think they should, and if you get bogged down and have to fight for that place block by block, house by house, I think the American people will be shocked at the casualties.
You report today that if it does come down to urban warfare in Baghdad, that we'll be relying on intelligence, including people on the inside of Saddam Hussein's regime, to tell us what the strategy is, where the key people are. How much intelligence do you think we have like that? Do you think that we're well armed with insiders in Saddam Hussein's regime that can help inform
us? I don't know
us.
How well armed we are. I know that we must have some sources. You know, remember that someone targeted Saddam Hussein for us. Someone inside, and I have to assume high up, put the finger on this block, this house, this is where they will be. And we came within a hair of getting them. So I assume we have some of that. I also assume that we will be infiltrating special forces operators, CIA operators, other intel forces who will help us pinpoint what we need to know. That's what they're counting on.
Now, what about the embedded reporters that you're working with? Would you want them to be there for urban warfare if it comes to that? Or do you think it's too dangerous and that they should get out?
No, I think if you have gone with a unit to the gates of the thing and they are going in, you should go with them. It'll be, you know, the risks increase very greatly, but you signed on knowing that there were risks, and you don't quit at the last minute and sit back and look through binoculars. I think you go on in with them.
Did you ever consider becoming an embedded reporter yourself for this war?
Oh, you know, and I'm an old fire horse, and when the bell goes off, I start dancing in my stall and leaning forward in my foxhole. But, you know, first of all, I'm 61 years old, and basically that's too old to go running with the 19-year-old kids in an armor column, and second of all, my lovely wife Karen said, "You can't go. I lost my father in one war. I'm not going to lose my husband in another, and I have to respect that."
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, a pleasure, Terry.
Joseph Galloway is military affairs correspondent for Knight Ridder Newspapers. He's the co-author of the book We Were Soldiers Once and Young, about a major battle he covered in Vietnam. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews the new memoir, The Only Girl in the Car. This is Fresh Air. Bookworms are often reserved people, but as journalist Kathy Dobie describes in her new memoir, The Only Girl in the Car, her early love of reading gave her a sense of possibility that was missing from her life. Maureen Corrigan has a review.
Talk about first impressions being fickle. After reading the opening chapters of Kathy Dobie's memoir, The Only Girl in the Car, which describe her childhood in Hamden, Connecticut, and the personalities of her parents and five siblings, I thought the book was mildly interesting, especially given that Dobie explores my own home turf of growing up Catholic in the 1960s and 70s. By the time I finished it, however, The Only Girl in the Car had gained the stature of an important book, the way other women's autobiographies, like Anne Moody's Coming of Age in Mississippi and Kate Simon's Bronx Primitive, are important, not just for the forcefulness of their individual life stories, but for what they add to the collective storehouse of information about the truth of different women's lives. No other memoir I've ever read has described a girl's coming of age with such frankness about sexual desire and sexual humiliation. The Only Girl in the Car also dramatizes how the seismic changes of the 1960s left a lot of adolescent girls, like Dobie, stranded, without a reliable roadmap telling them how to act as young women, what new pitfalls to avoid, what old social boundaries they could realistically hope to transgress. In the early 70s, Dobie's stay-at-home mom was still a lady in the 1950s mode, but contemporary music and pop culture were telling the teenage Dobie to be a cool hippie chick without hang-ups, like Peggy Lipton on the Mod Squad. What Dobie discovered, however, and what The Only Girl in the Car vividly documents, is that free love was still pretty much a male-only adventure. Yearning for the intimacy and attention that was hard to come by in her large family, the 14-year-old Dobie began dressing in tight jeans and halter tops and replacing her mother's vision of her with the gaze of men and boys. Displaying herself one afternoon on the front lawn of her parents' house, she reels in a 30-something loser driving by in a car. That night, she meets this guy to go to the movies and, with a steely resolve, loses her virginity. What follows is a whirlwind of sex with different rowdy boys, most of whom frequent the town's teen center. One of the most touching scenes in this memoir is when Dobie recalls how, one evening, four black boys who hang on the outskirts of the otherwise all-white center ask her to go on a car ride with them. Not to have sex, but to warn her that she's getting a reputation and keeping treacherous company. A short time later, she goes on another car ride with four other boys, three she thought were friends, one she thought loved her, and they gangbang her. Dobie admits she must have whispered the word okay before the horror began, because after all, that's what those boys expected of her. The boys, of course, brag about that night they spent with Dobie the dirtbag, and she becomes the town's teen pariah. That's another precious aspect of this autobiography, the way it dramatizes the rigid, categorical thinking inherent in adolescent culture. Dobie, according to the logic of teenage Tamden, got what she deserved. When she courageously tries to bluff things out and return to the teen center, she's literally stoned by the virginal girlfriends of the boys who had sex with her. Other boys, strangers, see her in a crowded park and surround her, cursing and throwing money at her. Here's how Dobie explains their twisted rationale. "They didn't know me, but I knew them, knew they were still virgins. And because I had gone, again and again, to the place they hadn't yet been, they hated me, even as they envied the boys I had sex with. I knew, too, that it gave them as much pleasure to hurt a girl, to poke her and see her twitch, as it would to make love to her. Either way, they would feel more like men when they were done." A love of reading partly got Dobie into this nightmare, because books gave her a sense of possibility that the real world couldn't fulfill. Literature also saved her. A high school English teacher confirmed Dobie's nascent sense of herself as a writer, and she eventually made it to college in New York City. I mentioned that 60s icon Peggy Lipton from the Mod Squad earlier, but the woman of the age whom the teenage Dobie really resembles is Janis Joplin, another sexual rebel who tried to claim boys' adventures as her own and psychologically and physically paid a horrible price. Janis more than even the score through her music. For Dobie, writing well is the best revenge.
Maureen Garrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Only Girl in the Car by Kathy Dobie. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Keeping Watch, a novel of suspense by Laurie R. King, author of Justice Hall and Folly. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, will the overthrow of Saddam Hussein make it a safer world? We talk with Christopher Dickey, Middle East Regional Editor for Newsweek magazine, about the new world of proliferation in which individuals, not just states, are increasingly capable of getting access to weapons of mass destruction. Join us for the next Fresh Air.